Hello, I'm David Kerr, Professor of Cancer Medicine from the University of Oxford, and today I'd like to welcome you to Medscape Oncology Insights, coming to you from the very heart of the Congress Centre here for the 2017 European Society for Medical Oncology. I'm absolutely delighted, of course, to be joined by my great friend and colleague, Professor Dirk Arnold, from the University of Hamburg. And today we'd like to talk a little about the highlights around colorectal cancerology, the disease which Dirk and I have been studying for, it feels like most of our lifetimes, really. But Dirk, you've played an important role in putting the programme together, a fantastic meeting, 23,000 people coming to ESMO, quality of the meeting of the very highest order. So what caught your eye in terms of colorectal cancerology?
David, thanks for the question and thanks for the introduction. Well, colorectal cancer is clearly not the top one focus here, although there have been some interesting reports also having been presented today. And the interesting thing is that we do see many new drugs entering the field of various cancer types. Yeah. In colorectal cancer, I think it's the years of consolidation what we currently do see.
And so you're being very, you know, as always, urbane, politically correct and so on. So is there not much going on in colorectal cancerology?
No, I wouldn't say that, but let's say we do see many novelties on posters and on the poster level, do see the immunotherapy combinations, etc. But if it comes to randomized trials, we don't have the data ready to be reported.
So nothing that's majorly practice-changing?
No, I think what we currently do have is some kind of adjustment of the current standards.
Yeah.
Then I would say the standards are then really at their top, and then we can now then compare them to the incoming novelties and new drugs.
Okay. So we're refining that which exists. I think there's a stronger international flavor because we've seen presentations coming from our colleagues from Japan and elsewhere and so on. But what caught your eye? What would you like to tell us about?
Today we had an interesting and also very lively discussion on treatment intensification on first-line treatment of patients with metastatic colorectal cancer. Mm. So the question was whether triple chemotherapy, which some countries like to say, to see as a standard, as we do know, some parts in Italy and others which like this high-intensity treatment. And this is the first trial which used a triple chemotherapy and then was questioning whether the addition of an anti-EGF receptor antibody will benefit patients. So this was a randomized trial coming from Germany, and a bit more than 100 patients underwent randomization. Primary endpoint was response rate, and in fact, and this is the surprising thing, response rate, even although being so high with triple chemotherapy, specifically here more than 60%, it could add another 25%. So we'll say we have now response rates of more than 86%. So meaning we can now have, at least with RAS wild-type patients, every patient responding, or nearly every patient responding. And that's interesting.
Now, so do you think, $64,000 question, that improvement in response rates will carry over into some substantial improvement in progression-free, but more importantly, overall survival?
Now, this is the open question which we still have to be answering. As we do have seen, progression-free survival was not improved. And this highlights, again, what we do have to see in colorectal cancer. It's not only inducing response, it's also, let's say, defining the whole strategy over the first-line treatment phase, then the second-line phase, the third-line phase, etc. So therefore, we can now see that we can increase treatment intensity, we can increase tumor decrease or tumor burden decrease. But the question is exactly, what does it mean?
And the cost to the patient, not the dollar cost, but the cost in terms of toxicity, mortality, and so on, is it a big difference?
It's clearly relevant. So there, with these regimen, toxicity becomes an issue.
Okay, so I guess patient selection is
It's clearly crucial, and also to define, let's say, the right population where patients do benefit from the relief of tumor burden, either being highly symptomatic or being, let's say, candidate for secondary resection, etc.
So we are old and wise enough to be philosophical. So we would always say, I think you'd agree, that cancer biology is king, patient selection is queen, if that's the case. Right. And one wonders if in selecting patients who are fit enough to withstand triple combination chemotherapy, with some bias that we don't understand, we might be selecting patients with a higher chance of responding, or I don't know.
I agree.
Possible?
Yeah. No, that's That's a good point.
I guess the other thing is that we are part of a multidisciplinary team, and think how aggressively we manage metastatic disease now with surgery, with radiofrequency ablation. But the idea that we can get that degree of tumour responsiveness might play into the MDT and open up increased possibilities about ablation, surgery. So it may have a, you know...
So I would say also this high treatment intensity regimen, if they are, let's say, intelligently used, you are not administering them for a long time. You're just inducing response, as we do in lymphoma or leukemia, et cetera, et cetera. And then we do have to define the best maintenance strategy, which could be ablation or resection or whatever, but could also be then the molecular targeted approach, willing selecting patients then and then using what we do in different trials. We use then immunotherapies or immunotherapy combination or signal transduction inhibitors plus immunotherapy to maintain what has been achieved during the first 12 weeks of treatment.
No, so I like that concept. I like the idea about a moderately intensive, pretty heavyweight chemotherapy to induce some further interventions if possible, and then seeing how we can step back a little. And I'm terribly interested in metronomic chemotherapy, low-dose, continuous, and so on.
Even this could play a role.
Okay, so you heard it here first. Okay.
At some point, metastatic colorectal cancer has become a kind of chronic myeloid leukemia. We do unselective cytoreduction and then play the weapons intelligently when we're in the chronic phase, or however you call this.
So away from here. So you heard it here first. This is good that our Medscape viewers have heard us philosophizing. But I think we could crystallize that into some really interestingly clever clinical trials. So, take. Anything else? What's happening across the water? Any word from the wise men in the East? Anything interesting happening with our colleagues in Japan or
We have seen here some evaluations how they use their home drug, their home fluoropyrimidine as one in these combinations, and achieving really great results across all molecular subtypes in substituting our fluoropyrimidine, meaning 5-FU capecitabine, with S1, also a randomized trial here. Very nice, very promising results. No idea whether this will be translatable one by one into a Caucasian population, into our treatment landscape, but interesting results.
But again, I think you draw an important point. Interesting results, but are they translatable? And although the more we understand of genetics, the more we realize we're the same, you know, we're genetically almost indistinct from mice, we know that. But there are some key differences in how Japanese, Chinese, Oriental patients metabolize anti-cancer drugs. And I think it does make a difference in terms of thinking how we translate those fascinating results into Caucasian populations.
Completely agree, David. And I have the feeling that in colorectal cancer, we are not, let's say, genetically, we are not that diverse, I would say. That's more or less one. Yeah, by contrast, in gastric cancer, diseases differ.
True.
So the GI field with these East and West comparison is very complex.
Oh, that's fantastic. And I guess the other thing that we must touch upon, I'd just be really interested in your take on duration of treatment of adjuvant therapy. We had our presentations at ASCO, Scott trial, this fantastic collaborative effort being one of them.
Right.
And just dead interested to see practically for our viewers how you condense those new data in the 3 versus 6 months into practical advice. So I'm faced with a 60-year-old patient in the clinic with a T4N1 tumor. What do I tell them? What do I do?
Nothing's easy. Yeah, that's really a tough story. What came out of all of these analyses, and there will be an extra session here tomorrow, and there will be an update of these 3 versus 6 months trials in their plethora of variety and whatever it is.
Sure.
But is the general finding is the differences are small. And whatever comes out as difference, be it statistically significant or non-significant, be it within the range of expected or diverging by 0.1%, et cetera, differences are small.
Sure.
And we have to have the patient on our focus, on our mind. And if we have this kind of intermediate or low-risk group, low risk for relapse in stage 3 disease, I think it's clearly to justify to give patients only 3 months of treatment.
Agreed. Could you categorize? So but remember, I'm a 60-year-old lawyer. I've decided I'm a lawyer now. I've got T4N1 disease.
Well, for legal aspects, I have to be sure just, what I do.
I'm a lawyer. That means I'm intelligent. Okay. I'm well-versed. It's nothing. I'm not going to sue you. But this is this is always the case that they make. Yeah. So what do you do with him?
Well, the complicated condition in his situation is that he has T4 disease. Mm. T4 disease would, for me, mean that he is in an intermediate to high risk group for relapse. So therefore, I would keep him on 6 months treatment. However, if this would be a T3 disease with, let's say, only one or two lymph nodes and an adequate lymph node sampling, then I would say this is a low risk condition, and then I would at least suggest 3 months.
I find myself agreeing entirely. How did that happen? So here we are, sort of two diverse, but I agree. I still think that for those younger, fitter patients with longer life expectancy coming with a greater burden of disease, and I know it's subgroup analyses, but I would favour the 6 months, right. I think, still. Yeah. Finding ways of trying to mitigate toxicity, but I would agree with you. Yeah. And it would just be so interesting to see how our viewers interpret the results in their own practice and follow that through. Yeah. That leads us to another discussion in another day about how we need real-world data as to what regimes are being used in the clinic and so on. Yeah. A discussion for another day. Yeah. But on behalf of our viewers and the audience, let me thank you for what's been a really interesting session. It's always enjoyable, you know, two friends chatting provocatively and so on. But thanks for coming along with the spirit. Thanks to all of you for watching. We'd be happy to take any points or comments that you like that you might want to make. But for the time being, Medscapers, over and out from ESMO. Thank you.